We're holding on Chavdalah Amud Beis, about six lines from the bottom of the narrowest lines. So lining in bold, right? Okay, further talking about this whole business of knocking out, the master knocks out the slaves, the average Kanani's eye or tooth, or as we'll say soon, any of various other important devotim, then he goes to eat. There's, by the way, a machlokas of showing him how many evarim are we talking about. Soon we're going to have, on Chafei Amud Aleph, we're going to have a list of 24 Rosh Evarim. Is it only those plus the eye and tooth? Or is it maybe other evarim as well? For example, yesterday we talked about the whole business of the jaw being dislocated or broken, and the Gemara said that an Eved goes out l'cheiris with that. Is that because in addition to that, the jaw is not going to be listed among the Rosh Evarim? So is it that any major Aver that he loses, or is it only, in the case of the Rambam, given the reason why the jaw gets him to go free, is because it prevents the teeth from working properly, and the teeth are in the list, because they're listed in the Torah. The question is, basically, when we have a list soon of 24 Rosh Evarim, that any of them Eved Yotze Behem L'Cheirus, plus Shen V'Ayin, is that list meant to be exhaustive? Or is it that we're going to have mentioned then that there's a chiddush in those 24 when it comes to the dinim of Torah? Anyway, turn it up on it. He called Ein Vekasa. Suppose that the master knocks, bangs on his Eved's eye, and instead of he doesn't knock him out, not knock it out or blind him completely, but it dims. He's not completely blind. He can see a little bit now. Summa would mean completely blind. Kasa means that his eye sight became dim. It's partially damaged. Al shinei v'nodo, he knocked him on a tooth and it became loose. Im yachalish damish ben achshav. So if he's still able to use them to some extent, ein eved yotze behem l'cheiros, then he doesn't go free with that. Achshav means right now. We don't look at how it's going to be later on. For example, In other words, the tooth, for example. No, in other words, the tooth, for example, eventually it may fall out, but right now it's not, and therefore he doesn't go l'cheiros with that. Only if later on, we'll talk about we'll say soon that if he removes the eye after it's blind, that's different. Actually, a bunch of Rishonim and Achronim deal with the question why with the tooth. We're saying over here, if he loosens it and it's still in his mouth, then he doesn't go free with it as long as he can still use it. And if at some later date he were to remove that tooth, he also wouldn't go free. What's the difference? They give a few different reasons. One of them is that the tooth eventually is more likely to fall out on its own than an eye. It's not going to fall out on its own. Another reason is an eye is more of an aver than a tooth. Anyway, so the imlav, and if not, Eved Yotze Behem L'Cheiros, then he goes free for the fact that his tooth was loosened because he can't use it anymore. The same thing with the eye that was partially blinded. Tanyedach, Bryson number 2, Haresha Hoysa Enei Kuhuya V'Sima. Suppose now that you have his eye was, to begin with, dim in sight. To begin with, he didn't have full vision in the eye, V'Sima, and then his master blinded him completely in that eye. Or shina nintuda v'hipila, or the tooth was loose and he knocked it out. Im yachalish damish ben kvar, so if he was previously able to use them at all, eved yotze ben l'cheiros, then now for the fact that it was knocked out, he does get to go free. V'im lav enyot eved yotze ben l'cheiros, and if not, then he doesn't go free. I think I'll point out a tzricha. We need both brightness. We wouldn't have been able to derive one from the other. If we were only told the first case, you would say the reason is mishum den re'ik and nohoda bar yavahash and nohoda chisha. You would say, you know why in the first brisa you would say he goes free? Because after all, he started out with perfect vision, and now you made his vision is damaged. So therefore, maybe that's reason enough to say that he goes free if now he can't use it. Here you could argue that to begin with his eyesight was bad. Okay, he was able to use it, but maybe it's not really fully considered an ayin. Now it's completely gone. Maybe you would say that not. Maybe if it was anyway half blind, then maybe making him completely blind is not enough of a mum to make him go free. That's why you need the second case. The Ashmin and Ha, and conversely, if you only told us the second case, you would say, Mishum the Sami Lagami, fine, you know why he goes free. The fact is he's now completely blind in that eye. Abel Hassan Belay Sami Lagami, in the first case he's not completely blind. But we're still saying he's not able to use it anymore. Amalo, you would think maybe not. So therefore we needed both cases.
And she used it, the milder case, and then make a cover home. But if it's milder, then you don't need a second case.
No, but that's what we're saying. You might have thought that if if he started out perfect and now he has lesser vision, okay, you ruined the fact he had perfect vision.
That I understand.
Fine, but and if you went the other way, you would argue only when he made him completely blind. Like this, you need to know both cases. Number one, where it was perfect and now it's damaged. It's still, he has some sight, but he can't really use it. And then you have to have the second case where he's partially blind, but he still was able to see something, and now you made him completely blind. Turn it up on him. On third rise, suppose that the Eved's master was a doctor, and the Eved one day asks him to put drops, or coil actually is paint, in his eye. They use it as an eye shadow as well as medicine. So he tells him to put in drops in his eye, vesima, and accidentally he blinded him in the process. Or lachter leshina, he tells him to scrape around his tooth, scrape off the plaque or whatever there is over there, the yipila, and by mistake, in the course of doing that, he knocked it out. Sichet ba'adin, and the eved can laugh now at the adin, v'yotzeh l'cheres, and he goes free. And you only did this because I asked you to treat me in the first place, but nevertheless, I get to go free because of it. Reb Shimon Gamliel, no. When the pasuk says that he destroys it in the case of the eye or the tooth, Ashias Gavin L'Shachsa, that implies that he has to be meaning to damage it in order for the eved to go free. So in these cases, Reb Shimon Gamliel says it wouldn't work. Okay, for Rabbanon Hai V'Shichsa Ma'ayavilei. Okay, what do the Rabbanon do with this word V'Shichsa? The answer is Meboilu L'Chidatanya. They use it for a different din that we learn in the Braisa, Rabbi Eliezer. Hareisha Hoshik Yodilim Eishivchas. So I suppose that the master sticks his hand into his Shivcha's womb to help deliver the baby. The Simei Obershavimera, and as he's poking around in there, he accidentally blinds the unborn baby. Then he's potter. Then he's potter. He doesn't have to let the uber go free when he's born, I guess. Right. My time of drama of Shikhsa actually is Kavan L'Shachsa, because I agree, the word Shikhsa means he has to have intention. The difference is there he Bakhla wasn't intending to touch the eye. Here, in the case of the Eved asked him, treat my eye, he did intend to touch the eye. He didn't mean to destroy it. That's why Shimon Gamliel is arguing that not. But the Chachamim say the very fact that you intended to touch the eye, even though the destruction was accidental, that's different. Actually, Tosfos discusses a little bit the issue over here, that when you need two factors, according to the Chachamim, to be potter from freeing the slave. In the case of the Ober, you have two factors. Number one, that you're doing it for a good purpose. You're trying to help deliver the baby. So fine, in that case, treating the Eved's eye, you have that as well, because you're trying to do good. But the other thing is that you weren't trying to touch the eye at all. In the case of the Ober, you had no intention of touching the eye. You just accidentally touched it as you're poking around in there. With the Eved, you meant to touch the eye. Therefore, that's the point of the Machlokes, where Reb Shimon Gamliel says the fact that you meant it for good, you weren't doing it for the purpose of L'Shachsa, is reason enough to not that the Eved doesn't go free for that. And Reb Shimon Gamliel says that it would.
So for Reb Shimon Gamliel, you need an intent.
You need an actual intent to damage.
And that makes it a criminal case.
No, not a criminal case per se, but it makes it a knas. It means that the Torah now imposes the knas that you have to free the slave. And by the way, the Tosfos Riya Zaken gives a different reason why it would be different in the case of an unborn baby. He says because an unborn baby is, you can't really say b'shachsa, you can't really say b'shichsa, that you have something that exists and now has been damaged, because like the baby in a certain sense doesn't fully exist yet. He's not an independent,
sure.
No, of course, we're talking about you trying to help deliver the baby, so of course it's well into the pregnancy, but nevertheless, though, as long as he's born, the expression, you can't really say he's damaged anything, because he hasn't started seeing with his eyes yet, before.
Even if he's born up for 30 days.
Well, it can be considered a nasal, yeah, okay, fine, but that's, the Chodah, once the baby is born, then it doesn't matter, you know. So what would Reb Shimon Gamliel answer to that? He would say, v'shiches shichsa nafta. He argues, the Torah could have said, k'yake yishasein abdeh v'shiches, that he damages. Instead he says, v'shichasa, that he damages it. So from that ribui, from the fact that it says v'shiches, and the fact that it has the hay at the end, you can learn both dinim. That you need to be having in mind to touch the eye, and number two, that you have to have in mind to be damaging. Which in the case of treating the Eved's eye, you don't have the second factor because you didn't intend to do damage. the Idach and the Tanakhama would answer Shichas Shichta Lo Darsh. They don't darsh in that kind of detail. Omer of Sheshes, Harei Shehoyta Einei Smuya. Suppose that the Eved's eye was already blind. So now, previously, so we started out, we had the case where the eye was healthy and you weakened the sight in it. Then we had a case where the sight was weak already and then you blinded him. Now you have a third case. The eye was already blinded, v'chatata, and then the master pulled it out, or removed it from his head. What?
Socket.
Yeah, from the socket. Eved yoytze ben l'cheres. That also the Eved goes free. My time of mechutz eiver. Why? Because at that point, he's missing an eiver. Yes, even though it was already blind, it was non-functional, but removing it makes it a new mum that didn't exist before. The Tana Tuna, and indeed we learn a Tana says a similar thing in a Braisa. We find that in the Dinim of Korbanos, Tamus v'Zachrus v'Behema, by an animal for a Korban it has to be a Tomim, it has to not have any Mumim, and for certain Korbanos, an Oila in particular, it has to be a Zachar, it has to be a male animal. In Tamus v'Zachrus v'Oifus, those rules do not apply to a brood Korban. When you bring an Oila for Oif, it does not have to be a Tomim, and it does not have to be a male. Yochol Yoshagapa, well by that logic you would think, even if, let's say, one of its wings dried up, or nixta aragla, or its foot was cut off, or nechta ena, or its eye was pulled out, you would think that then it's still a kosher carbon. No, therefore we have a passage that says that you can only bring a carbon from the bird, from being a mute, only certain kinds of birds. So there are limitations. So it can't be mechusar eiver. The point of it being, in other words, if the bird was just blind, then it would still be kosher of the carbon. But if the eye is actually removed, then that's considered mechusar eiver, and therefore the bird is possible of the carbon. Same logic over here then. The eved was blind beforehand, but now you removed the eye. That makes a whole new situation. Interesting thing, by the way, Tertius points out that this whole concept of mechusar eiver applies in general across the board to korbanos of goyim. A korban that a goy wants to bring to our base of mikdash has to follow our rules. That's what we learned about in Gittin, about the animal that Bar Kamsa brought, where he split its lip or he split its eyelid or whatever, and then there was a mum and they wouldn't bring another korban. But if a goy wants to bring a korban on a bama of his own, which they're allowed to even nowadays, then the same rules apply to animals as well. It can't be mechusar eiver, but it could be a bal mum. Interesting word that Meshech Chochma says on this. He says, "Sataka, why by us is there a difference between birds and animals?" He says, because after you find that Noach, after he came out of the Teva, brought birds and animals as korbanos, after that you never find, from Avraham Avinu and on, you never find anybody up until the Torah was given bringing birds as a korban. Therefore, the rules for birds for us remain the same as they were for Bnei Noach, for all animals. Animals, in other words, you find Avraham Avinu bringing korbanos, so therefore new rules apply. But birds, you never find him or Yitzchak or Yaakov or anybody bringing until the Eved gives the mitzvah of Oila Sa'if and Chata Sa'if and Parshas Vayikra. Therefore, the rules stay the same for them as they were for Bnei Noach. Anyway. Omer of Chiba, Ashi Omer Rav, another din about these din. Omer of Chiba, Ashi Omer Rav, Hoysela Yiseres V'Choska. Another case, what if the Eved has an extra finger and the master cut it off? And he will go free for that. This is only if that finger is in the same row as the rest of the fingers. Then it's considered a real honest-to-goodness aver. Otherwise, not. I'm going to tell the case, which...
It has to be in line.
It has to be, in other words, that he has six fingers with six fingers in the same line as the rest of them. Yeah. If it's not, then it's not considered an aver, and cutting it off wouldn't let him go.
Why did you
find nothing? It's a good question. I don't know. The question is, what if a person has only five fingers, but one of them is not in the same row as the rest of them? Would that be considered if he's cut off that extra one? Maybe it would be the same thing. But if it's not Vurushin Esperos or Kavayad, it can't really be considered a finger.
Because it's not Esperos.
Okay. That's what we're saying. If it's Mispera Fagavayad, it can be considered part of an aver. It can be considered an actual aver. If not, then if it grows over here, for example, then not. So now the Gemara tells a story which is going to lead up to the... So now the Gemara is going to tell us a story that leads up to the actual definition of what are considered the Rosh HaYivarim for this purpose. Sovid Yinizunia The elders from the Chacham of Nezunya, the name of a city, Moy also Pirkei de Rav Chista. They did not come to Rav Chista's shiur. So he tells Rav Hamnuna, who was a Talmud Chaver of his, he was a younger colleague of his, he tells him, Zilt Saninu. Go and Saninu. Now, what does Saninu mean? Rashi says Saninu is Meloshen Tznius, meaning, put him in Nidui for not coming to the Shir. But you don't openly tell a Talmud Chacham you're in Nidui. It's not respectable. We learned that in Moed Katan. So therefore, like, tell them, stay home. Stay Tzniustik in your own houses. Different other explanations. The Oruch says that Saninu means yell at them. And Ben Yehuda says, what's the Vart? I mean, what is Rav Chista so concerned about the fact that they didn't come? He says, because the Amei Oretz are going to learn from it like this. The Talmud Chacham aren't coming, and the Amei Oretz aren't going to bother coming either, and then nothing's going to get taught.
Did he come a couple of times or just once?
Maybe it was just the once, I don't know.
We should try that.
Okay. Also, my time will also have one of the pictures. Rav Hamnuna goes and asks them, how come you didn't come to Rav Chista's shir? And by the way, this pirka is a shir, we find in the writings of the Gaonim and whatever, that in particular pirka was a shir on practical halacha. So therefore, that fits with what Ben Yehuda is saying. It's very important that the Amei Oretz should know they have to come to that to actually learn halacha l'maisa. So if these guys aren't showing up, then yeah. So they answered him back, Amai Nasi. Well, why should we bother going to be in Minimil Sivle Poshatlan? We asked him something and he didn't answer us. So if he doesn't know, then why should we bother? Actually, Ben Yehuda says it's not so much that he didn't know the answer. It's like they said, when an Amoritz asks a question, you just answer him with the halacha without getting into the details. He's not going to understand it anyway. When a Talmud Chacham asks a question, he's supposed to give him an answer with details and all. He just gave us an answer like he would give to an Amoritz. So what do we need that for? Amnuna tells him, "Mi b'risa minai, mi divlai p'shitin l'chu." You know what? Have you ever asked me anything and I didn't answer you? Meaning, Ben Yehuda continues the discussion, Rav Hamnuna is saying, I am Rav Chista's maturgimon. Yes, if Rav Chista gives a brief answer, it's my job to explain it in more detail. If you get a brief answer from him and you're not satisfied with it, come to me. I've never let you down. So, Bohumine. So they asked him as follows. Eved shesirse rabbe bebeitzim. What if an Eved, his master, castrated him by removing one or both of his beitzim? Now, what would be the din? Is that considered a visible mum or not? If it's a visible mum, then he goes free, like we said yesterday. It's like Shen Vain. If not, then it's the equivalent of like removing an internal organ, and it wouldn't. Loi have a biyade. He didn't know the answer. Amru loi mashimcha. So they asked him, by the way, what's your name? Amru lohu hamnuna. Amru loi, they said to him, in that case, if you don't know the answer, lav hamnuna ela karnuna. Not hamnuna, but kaununa. So what does that mean? So one second. So Rashi says kaununa is meloshen keren. You're like a Yoshev Kronis. You're like one of these people who sits idle on street corners rather than a Baal Torah. So the Rashba explains that according to that, what they meant is hamnuna would be meloshen hemenusa, which means like something reliable, like somebody who reliably is there in the Beis Medrash. You're not like that. You're like a Yoshev Kronis. Tosus gives a different explanation from Rabbeinu Hananel that hamnuna, ham is like ham, meaning hot. And nuna is the Aramaic word for a fish. So they tell him, if you don't know this kind of thing, you don't deserve to be called ham, ham nuna, meaning the hot, a hot fish, but rather karnuna, a cold fish, like who wants to eat cold fish? Anyway, also the Kamedon of Chista, so Hamnuna went to ask Rav Chista, so Taka, what would be the deal in this case? Omrullah, and he answers him, you know what, Mafisa Bomenach, actually, what they asked you, you can find the answer in a Braisa. As follows, the Tanan, we start out with a Mishnah in Masechta Negayim, Negea to this week's Parsha, actually. Esrim Vaba Rosh Evarim Shav Adam, the 24 tips of limbs in a person, Kulam Ein Matamin Mishum Michya. None of them become Tomei if there's a Michya over there. So in this week's Parsha, you have a person has Tzaraf, and in the middle of the Tzaraf spot, there's an area of healthy looking skin. That's an automatic Simen Tumah. The person is automatically definitely Tomei and has to go outside the city and tear his clothes, etc., etc. If that michya is on the tip of one of the tips of the limb that we're going to have a list in a minute, then the person is not Tomei. Reason is, Rashi says, because the din is, and this actually doesn't necessarily just apply to a michya, it applies to a regular spot of Tzaraas also. It has to be that we learn from a pasuk, the Kohen has to see the entire spot or the entire michya all at once. And a michya or a spot of Tzaraas has a minimum size. If you have, for example, a Tzaraas spot, let's say, on the end of a, on a fingertip, you're not going to be able to see the whole thing at once because part of it is on the top and part of it is on the side. You have to turn the finger this way and that to see the whole thing. Therefore, it's not Tumah. Rashi mentions on this week's parasha that, let's say, for example, you have a person started off with skinny fingers, and then at some point, while the tzaraas was on them, his fingers ended up becoming fat, and now you have room enough for the whole tzaraas spot to be on the top of it, then yes, he would be tummy. But under normal circumstances, no. So, the Elohim, and they are as follows, Rashi etzbet yidayim v'raglayim, the fingertips and the tips of the fingers and the toes, so that's 20. V'rashi osnayim, the earlobes, those are considered as one, so that's 21. V'roish ha'choytem, the tip of the nose, 22. V'roish ha'gviya, Rosh Hashanah are considered separate, 21 and 22. 23 is the tip of the nose, and 24 depends on whether it's a man or a woman. For a man, V'roish ha'gviya means the tip of the male organ, that would be the 24th for a man. V'roish ha'dadim shebe'isha, or the tips of the breasts, the nipples, for a woman, because they stick out. A man's are flatter, but a woman's stick out. Rabbi Huda says a man's nipples also stick out enough to have the same din. But anyway, so according to him, okay, you'd have 25. Thus far the Mishnah. Then a Braisa adds, V'tani Allah, B'kulam Eved Yetzvam L'Chiris. All of those, a slave would also go free if one of them gets knocked off. And the Braisa continues, Rebbi Oma Achas Sirus. Rebbi adds, another thing that would let him go free is Sirus, is castration. Ben Azar says also if his tongue is cut off, because the tongue is sometimes visible. You see a person's tongue when he speaks. Well, that's what we're going to talk about. So now thus far the Braisa. Now Rav Chisda says, let's analyze it. Sirus demai. What kind of castration are we talking about? Ilema sirus de gid. Are we talking about that he chopped off the gid, the actual organ? Hainu gria. Well, we just said Rosh Agria was on the list of 24. Everybody agrees to that one. Elolav sirus de beitzim. Evidently, we must be talking about that he castrated him by removing one or both of the beitzim. And therefore, we have a machlokes. Therefore, we have a machlokes. The Tanakhama says that doesn't count, and Rebbe says it does. So there you go. Then that answer to what the Sovid in Azunia asked you is the machlokes fanoim. Okay. So now we say Rebbe Omar sirus. So what? Rebbe losh and loy. Are you telling me that Rebbe would say that if the master cuts off the Eved's tongue, then he doesn't go free for that? That he does that is not considered a visible organ, in other words, or a minu, have a contradiction. A Braisa says, in a different context, Harei Mishayim Maze, a person is sprinkling paradrum water, the Nitza Hazar Alpiv, and a drop of the water landed on his mouth. Rebbe Omehizer, Rebbe says that's considered a valid Hazar, and the person becomes tar from it. Talking mess, obviously. Macham say it doesn't work. If it's not considered a valid hazah, it has to land on some other area of his skin. Now, when we say his mouth, my lab al l'shoyne l'chura. When we say that it landed on his mouth, the pashas we mean it lands on his tongue. And we're saying then that Rebbe would consider it no good because it has to land on some exposed part of his body. Whereas the chachamim would say, the other way around. Rebbe would say that it's fine. Rebbe would say that it's fine, meaning that this tongue is considered to be an exposed thing. So if it's exposed, then why would an Eved not go free if his tongue was cut off? The answer is not necessarily. You could say that the machloitis is where the hazar landed on his lips. That question is asfasa pshita. If it lands on his lips, of course it's pasha that it should be fine. Why would there be a problem? Why would the chachamim say it's no good if it lands on his lips? The answer is, and why would Rebbe have to tell us the chiddush that it's good? The answer is, ma'od tema zimnin to cholim svafe. You could answer that, yes, it's true, the lips normally are exposed, but after all, you can purse your lips where they're not visible, so therefore maybe it should be considered like a hidden part of the body.
Purse them where they're not visible?
Like that. Yeah? So... So in that case, maybe a taka should be considered a hidden part of the body. Well, that would be Rebbe's chiddush that nevertheless we're not concerned about that, whereas the chachamim would be disagreeing. You can't necessarily prove that what they'd say about the tongue, though. It could be that both Rebbe and the chachamim would agree that the tongue is definitely considered a hidden part of the body. Yes, you do see it when a person's speaking, but normally it's hidden inside the mouth. But the person doesn't normally stick out their tongue when they eat. No, it doesn't mention Shen Vahim because they're explicit in the pasuk, so it's only mentioning the ones that are not. And like I said before, by the way, there is a machlokas rishonim. Is the list in the Braita meant to be exhaustive, or is it just the Mishnah had mentioned the Rosh Yevarim because the chiddush with them is that nichya doesn't apply to them. But for example, a person has tzaraas and his jaw, let's say, then nichya would apply over there. Whereas when it comes to an eved, maybe we would say, like we learned yesterday, that a dislocated jaw would also let him go free because it is visible. Or again, we could argue, like the Rambam, that the list is exhaustive and a dislocated jaw is different because it prevents the teeth from functioning, and the teeth are on the list. We're not saying that you're allowed to do it, but if you did it, then, yeah. Okay, the Gemara says, Valtanya, very nice. So you're explaining the machlokas of Rebbe and the Chachamim as far as Hazar is talking about if the Hazar landed on his lips. That's not talking about his tongue. Valtanya al Lashoinai. Okay, but you have a Braita that explicitly says that they're arguing about if it landed on his tongue. Va'oitanya, and besides that, we have another case. That bears on this. A case of the dinim of what's considered a mum by an animal. The in Sefer Bechoris, it has the whole list of mumim of animals, because the context is over there that if a Bechor develops one of these mumim, then you don't bring it to the Korban. You can check it anywhere in the world, and then Korinim can eat it. Some of these mumim also apply to people, that's Korinim, to serve or not serve in a Mishmetesh. And one of the ones on the list is Vishnita Rav HaLoshen, if most of the tongue is removed. Rebbe Omer Rav Amadaber Bilashana. And Rebbe says it doesn't have to be most of the tongue, it just has to be most of the part of the tongue that speaks. Now animals don't speak, but we mean, in other words, the loose part of the tongue. If you ever look at pictures like ones that they have for first aid, you know, for first aid diagrams or whatever, you have the loose part of the tongue that flaps, and then you have a huge part of it that's permanently inside the mouth.
So but if you remove the back, you have to remove the front.
No, obviously. But in other words, the point is that the Tanakhama is saying that when is it considered a mum, only if you look at the whole tongue as an aggregate, if most of that was removed. Then you would say you ignore the part of that. You for purposes of figuring out what's the majority of the tongue, you only look at the flapping part. Anyway, the point is that Rebbe clearly holds that that's considered a mum. Again, when it comes to a bechor, anything that's internal is not considered a mum. For purposes of shechting it, of shechting it as a korban, or shechting it outside the Beis Mikdash anyway, if it's a treta, that's a whole other matter, but anyway. So why over here would Rebbe be saying that removing Eved's tongue doesn't let him go free? Why would he say here it's not considered something exposed? Ella, no. What we mean is like this. Rebbe Omer Sirus V'loy Mibayaloshen. No, what we mean when we quoted the Braisa before is Rebbe says that castration, moving the basin, is considered a mum shebegalui, and the eved goes free for it. How much more so if you move the tongue? Okay, so then what do you mean? Ben Azay Omer Loshen Loshen Aval Sirus Loy. And then what is, when Ben Azay says Af HaLoshen, Ben Azay is not coming to add to Rebbe. We assumed up until now that what we have is like this. We have the Tanakhama, and Rebbe is adding another thing on top of the Tanakhama, Achasirus, and Ben Azay is coming to add on top of Rebbe. Now we're saying no. Rebbe's and Ben Azay's statements are independent of each other. Rebbe is saying Sirus as well as what Ben Azay had previously said. Ben Azay was in a previous generation, Loshen. And Ben Azay, when he says Ach, my af akamaita. Ben Azay is referring back to the original Braisa before Rebbe said his piece. So when Ben Azay says af aloshen, he means besides the list of 24, if you have a Rebbe Yehuda, 25 that we said, besides in the case of an Evet, Shein V'ayin, Ben Azay is adding also the tongue, but not Sirus. As opposed to Rebbe says Sirus as well as the tongue. Okay. The question is, Yehochan Nikhtamid Ben Azay Bereisha, then why is the Braisa ordered like that? Braisa should first have the Tanakhamas and Rebbe Yehuda's opinion, then Ben Azay, then Rebbe, if Rebbe is agreeing with Ben Azay and adding something else. The answer is Tana Shama l'Rebbe V'kava, because historically what happened is the Tana who taught this Braisa, first he heard of Rebbe's opinion, so therefore he made it official, he put it in the text of the Braisa. Not he held by it, he heard that Rebbe held, he heard first that Rebbe had an opinion different than the Tanakhama. Therefore, he put it into the Braisa, and people started learning the Braisa that way. Remember, everything was Baal Peh in those days. So people learned that became the official text of the Braisa. V'shamala ben Azay v'tani. Later on, he found out that, you know what, Ben Azay has a different opinion as well. So therefore, he stuck it in afterwards. He didn't interrupt. He didn't put it in its proper place before Rebbe's opinion, because the Mishnah is also Mekayma, because the wording of the Mishnah doesn't change from how it originally was. Once you have, people have gotten used to learning it this way, that first you learn the Tanakhama's opinion, and immediately after that, Rebbe, it would be confusing if you now had to relearn to stick Ben Azai's opinion in the middle. Therefore, he just stuck in Ben Azai's opinion at the end, and we have to understand for ourselves that Ben Azai is not coming to add to Rebbe, but to give an alternative to him.
Why do we have to know that?
Well, we have to know that because that way we don't have a contradiction. That way we don't have a contradiction between what Rebbe is saying.
Ben Azai lived
later in time? Ben Azai was earlier than Rebbe, actually. But historically, the Tana first found out Rebbe's opinion, and later on he found that, you know what, in a previous generation, Ben Azai had his opinion. Now, everybody agrees, both Rebbe and the Chachamim, that when it comes to Tumah, when it comes to Tumas Sheretz, for example, or Tumah of any kind of touching, the tongue is considered an exposed organ. So meaning, in other words, if a person were to touch a Sheretz or any other source of Tumah with his tongue, he would become Tameh. A dead Sheretz. What? A dead Sheretz, yeah, it has to be a dead Sheretz. A live Sheretz isn't a Tameh. My time, Asher Yigabai Omer Achmona, because the Pasuk mentioned the term that he touches, a tongue is capable of touching something, so therefore a person can become tameh by his tongue touching something. Rashi goes into a little bit of detail over here the din is maga beis astarim. If a source of tumah touches somebody in a hidden part of their body, then they don't become tameh from it.
So the axillary.
That would be one example. The armpit, yeah. We learn that from the fact that this pasuk that we say Asher Yigaboy is talking about a zov, and the next words in the pasuk are v'yadav le'shata samayim, which literally means he didn't rinse. It's the next week's parasha. Literally means he didn't rinse his hands in water. But we learn in Torah Shavah Peh, and Rashi explains it on the pasuk also, that a zov washing his hands doesn't make a difference as far as tumah v'tahara. It means he has to tovel after his zivus is finished. But the fact that it mentions hands teaches us that only the exposed parts of the body are subject to tumah v'tahara, as we're going to say soon about dipping in the mikveh, that the hidden parts of the body don't need to actually, a person, the mikveh water doesn't need to get into a person's mouth, for example.
So the nostrils also?
Right. We're going to say soon, they have to be royal of BS9 way. Let's get to it. They have to be clean enough that water could penetrate them, but not that it actually has to. Anyway, if it's about the same token then, so yeah, if a get sheretz were to touch base of sturim, a concealed part of a person's body, part of a person's body which is always concealed, it wouldn't be metamahim. But his tongue, we're saying, is considered exposed for this purpose because it is capable of reaching out and touching things. In its tzvila, ketamun dami. On the other hand, when it comes to tovling, everybody agrees that the tongue is considered like something hidden. So therefore, the water of the mikveh doesn't have to actually touch your tongue. You don't have to open your mouth. My time of berachas sora b'mai mamar achmana, because the pasuk says, when it talks about somebody tovling, it says he has to wash his flesh, his skin, in water. So ma b'sore me'avroi, afkol me'avroi, just like his skin is external, everything else that has to be touched in contact with the mikveh water only has to be external. So the machlokas of Rebbe and the Chachamim is strictly as far as the case of sprinkling paradam water. Rebbe medame lo l'tumah. Rebbe makes a comparison between tumah and paradama. So just like with tumah, a person can become tamei with his tongue touching something that is something that's tamei. The same way when it comes to tara, the tara paradama, if it's sprinkled on his tongue, then if the water lands on his tongue, it'll become tara. But Rabbanan, Madama lo tevila, and then Rabbanan compare it to tevila. Just like with tevila, the tongue doesn't have to touch the mikvah water. So also with hazah, the part of the water touching the tongue doesn't help anything.
Wouldn't make him
tara, right? B'chavayu, actually, what it is they're both arguing about the meaning of the following pasuk. The pasuk says, the pasuk says by paradruma, the tahor sprinkles on the tummy. So the whole pasuk goes like this: v'hiz atar al tummy by yema shlishi or by yema shvi, he sprinkles on him on the third and seventh day. V'chitay by yema shvi, he cleanses him on the seventh day. V'chibas pigadav, at that point the tummy mat washes his clothes, meaning dips his clothes in a mikvah. V'rachas v'mayim, he himself goes to the mikvah v'tarei ba'arav, and he's pure in the evening. Rebbe learns the pasuk like this. Rebbe Saba, v'hi's atara l'tama b'yemashlishi v'yemashvi. So where the pasuk starts off, the tahor sprinkles on the tama on the third and the seventh day, v'chitay, and he cleanses him. So therefore, in other words, we put together, we sort of have a hekesh of ala tama and v'chitay. So whatever applies to becoming tame applies to b'chita, applies to the tara process. Just like he can become tame by his tongue touching a sheret, so he can become tara by b'chita, by the paradrum, by the water touching his tongue, the paradrum water. Rabbanan savri b'chita by yemashvi b'chita sgada b'rachas l'mayim. Whereas the rabbanan, now looking at the second half of the pasuk, he cleanses him on the seventh day and he dips his clothes and himself in the mikveh, implying that the comparison is between b'chita and going to the mikveh. So just like going in the mikvah, tongue isn't relevant. Neither is it by paradruma. Okay. Question is, Rabbanan nami nizami l'truma. Why don't the Rabbanan compare it to the case of truma? Why don't they agree with Rebbe's hekesh in the first half of the pasuk? They say tara mitara hable lemelach. After all, they say it's more logical to derive one case of tara from another case of tara. A mikvah makes a person tar, paradruma water makes a person tar. It's more logical to derive one from the other. Whatever applies to one applies to the other. Okay, the question is, Rebbe Nidami Litvila, let's go back to Rebbe. Why doesn't he compare the case of paradruma to Tovelin? The answer is because of Chibet God of Hifsikinian. He says, yes, it's true you have a hekish, it's true you have in the same pasuk the word v'chita and the dipping in the mikvah. But in between them you have the v'chibet God of dipping his clothes in the mikveh. That, he says, interrupts it. That removes the hekesh. So therefore, you only have one hekesh in the pasuk between tumah and paradumah. Well, very well, then that's the hekesh that we use. Tosfos, by the way, discusses the question that going back to the original topic of Shen V'ayin of the Eved. So we're saying that Rebbe says that the tongue, when it comes to Parah Adruma, is considered an exposed organ. What's that got to do with the whole thing of the Eved? Okay, Tosfos says, because Shein, after all, a tooth is considered an exposed thing as far as the Eved. He goes free with it. When it comes to tevila, though, your teeth don't have to be exposed to the mixed water either. So therefore, it's not necessarily the same exact kind of thing.
So exposed, then you say the tongue is also exposed.
Ain't a chanamid, and that's the point. You don't have to open your mouth and mix it. So therefore, the tongue can be considered an exposed organ as far as the eved. Just as the teeth are. It can be considered an exposed organ as far as tumma, which we're saying everybody agrees to that. And it can be considered not exposed as far as, and it can also be considered exposed, according to Rebbe, as far as paradruma, but not for tevila. Tevila would be a different thing. Okay, the Gemara asks, the Sava Rebbe in the tevila ketamun dummy. Really, are you telling me then that the tongue and the teeth, for that matter, are considered like something hidden when it comes to toveling, and you don't have to open your mouth and when you're toveling? Well, Amar Robin, Amar of Ada, Amar of Yitzchak, Maisa b'shivcha shabes Rebbe shtavla v'olsa. It happened once that a shivcha in Rebbe's household one time toveled. And maybe she was toveling for Nida, I guess, but not necessarily to be mutter to her husband. I don't know if an Eved Ivri would be chayev in the dinim of Tara for Mishpacha, but it may have just been for Tumah V'Tara. In Rebbe's times, people were still careful with Tumah V'Tara. They still had leftover Parah Aduma, and we find in a Gemara in Chagiga that implies that they still had leftover Parah Aduma ashes from 100 years earlier from the end of the Beis Hamikdash, and they still used them. Anyway. So she toveled, she came out of the mikveh, the nimsa etzem ben shineha, then they found a bone between her teeth, so that there was a chatzitza over there between her teeth, v'itzricha Rebbe tevila acheres, and Rebbe required her to tovel again. So therefore, you see that water does have to get into the mouth and between the teeth and so forth. The man says, no. Nihid b'yis mayim lo be'inin, mokamo loy lover b'mayim be'inin. No. Actually, what it is we taka don't require that water actually get into the mouth. But it has to be that it would be able to get in. That if you were to open your mouth, the water would be able to get everywhere in your mouth, including between your teeth. Therefore, chatzitza is a problem. Kidu Reb Zeira, and this is like what Reb Zeira says, the Omer Reb Zeira, famous expression that we have throughout Shas, Kol Adroi Levila Ein Vila Makeves Boi, in the case of Menachos, we've had this line before. We had it, I think, in Pesugos, that the din is a Kovan Mincha. We know from a couple of weeks ago, Pasha, that that's flour and oil mixed together. The din is the maximum size of a Kovan Mincha. The maximum is 60 isarin. A normal Kovan Mincha consists of one isarin. The maximum you can bring in one keli is 60 isarin. Gemara in Menachos discusses a couple of reasons. One is because the largest number of Menachos that the Tzibur ever brings on one day, and that's when the first day of Sukkot comes out on Shabbos, I think it is, then you have 61, so therefore Yosef should bring maximum 60, don't be as much as the Tzibur. And then the other reason the Mishnah brings over there from Ibn Huda is because 60 is the maximum that you would be able to actually mix together the flour and the oil properly. And Isarin is a shir chava, so somewhere between, somewhere in the neighborhood of three or four pounds of flour. So 60 Isarin, you're talking about something like 200 pounds. Yeah. So larger than that, you can't mix it properly. Okay, I mean, nowadays maybe you can get a cement mixer or something, but you can't do it by hand. So the Chachamim asked Rabbi Yehuda, so what's the problem? We know that, so what, if the mincha is not mixed together, we know it's kosher. If you bring a korban mincha and the flour and the oil are in the keli, but they're not mixed, it's still a kosher mincha. And he answers them with this expression, the Rabbi Zeira paraphrases it, kol aroy lebila, anything which could be mixed, ein bila makeves bo, then the bila does not prevent it from being kosher. So smaller, a mincha 60, sorin or smaller, you could mix it, therefore if you didn't mix it, it's fine. The mitzvah, you need to be able to. Roshayna, roy lebila, bila makeves bo. If you can't physically mix it because it's too hard, then it's makev. Same thing over here. If there's no bone over there and water could have gotten between the teeth, then it doesn't matter whether it did or not. But if there is a bone there, if the water couldn't have gotten there, then it's a chitzitza, and then you need to tovel again. Going back to this whole question about sirus, about removing the basim, we said before, we established before that the machlokes of Rebbe and the Chachamim. So now we have another, we have other tanoim who also argue on the same topic. The pasuk says in Parshas Emor when it lists various mumim that apply to animals for korbanos, u'moch v'chasus v'nosuf v'karus, four different ways of damaging the organs. Moch is squeezed, kasus crushed, nosuk is pulled off, karus is cut off. Anyway, kulam bebeitzim, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that all four of these things apply to the beitzim. Well, wait. So the question is, you want to ask the beitzim, the Levi did, what do you mean they only apply to the beitzim, not to the actual organ? Ella kulan ask the beitzim. No, what Rabbi Yehuda means is they apply also to the beitzim. Not only, there's no question, Rabbi Yehuda is saying if you cut off or pull off or whatever, the actual organ, no question at the moment. But even the beitzim, even though they're hidden inside the kist over there, inside the scrotum, they're still, it's considered a mum shibagolui if they're crushed or pulled loose from the cords that they're suspended by or whatever. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, no, all of them only apply to the gid. So therefore, in other words, according to him, anything that happens with the basin is not considered a mum shibagolui, because they're hidden inside their sack over there, and you don't see them. Rabbi Yossi, the moch b'kosus after basin, not the b'kosus b'gid in the basin lo. Rabbi Yossi says it depends. The first two, moch and kosus, apply to the basin and to the gid. The other two, nosuk and karus, pulled off or cut off, only apply to the gid, doesn't apply to the basin. But therefore, so we see you have different opinions whether things that are done to the basin are considered a mumshu begolui or not, and therefore that bears on the smachlokas as far as the evid as well. Interesting thing, the Haflah brings in Hamakne, he asks the question, we know there's an isser to castrate any animal or human being. If a person does that, he's chayav malchus. If he's chayav malchus, how can you also give him a knas of having to flee the eved? And he gives a couple of answers, one of them being that they are two independent things, and therefore, yes, you could have both. Then he gives other answers. You might have done it for shoygig, and then you're not chayav malchus, but you'd still have the knas of fleeing the eved. Or he says another possibility is you didn't do it directly, let's say, by actually going in and doing an operation and chopping them off. You did, for example, the scenario that Amram talks about where, let's say, you made the guy sit in the snow until they froze off. If he didn't do it directly, he wouldn't be chayv malchus for that. But nevertheless, it was he did damage them, and therefore the eved would go lecheirus if we say it's moshe b'gavul.
I'm going to have a clean kaderus because a kohen who has any of those problems is not allowed to duchen. But for a kohen, it is a mumin.
Not allowed to duchen, says who? A kohen is allowed to duchen with mumin. A kohen is not allowed to duchen with mumin that are exposed to everybody because then people are going to look at him instead of concentrating on the brother. A kohen, so as far as I know, can duchen. He can't work in the Beit Hamikdash. It is true. The mumin that we're talking about over here for animals do apply to human beings also. And in fact, that I'm unpacking like Rabbi Yehuda, that all of these things apply equally well to the Beit Hamikdash and to the Gid, both for animals and for people. Fine, but that's... Regardless, I mean, according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and according to Rabbi Yossi, some of these things are considered mumim shebaseser. Again, just like for example, a kohen had to undergo surgery and have, I don't know, a lung removed or some other internal organ, doesn't pass them from working in the mikdash. According to them, neither would these. Okay. On to the next kind of pinyon. Now, so far, we started off with pinyon of Isha. Then we had an Eved Ivri going down the ladder, and then we had an Eved Kanani. Now we're down to animals. Behema Gasa Nichnas B'Mesira. A Behema Gasa, a large animal, like a cow or a horse or whatever, you koine B'Mesira by handing it over. So Rashi describes that means, that the original owner takes, for example, the reins or the hair or whatever, and hands it over to the buyer to here, take it. Tosfos discusses a little bit, does that actually have to be, or maybe is it good enough if the guy just takes the reins or whatever on his own? Rashi learns that when we say Nichnas B'Mesira, it means only Mesira. According to Rashi, Meshicha would not work for such animals because it's not normal, it's not the usual thing to have such animals walk in front of you. Therefore, Meshicha wouldn't work, according to Rashi. Again, Tosfos discusses that at some length over here and comes to the conclusion that no, it means the other way around. It means that you can do Meshicha for sure. Even you can do Mesira, as opposed to a Behema Daka where Mesira wouldn't work. Daka Bagba, a Behema Daka, a small animal, like a sheep or a goat, can be Nikneh by picking it up. And again, Rashi learns that means not by Meshicha. You literally have to pick it up.
Yeah, well, why do we need to know that? Of course, Hagbah is not.
No, but the point is only Hagbah works. If you do Meshicha, if you buy a sheep from somebody and you do Meshicha on it, give it a mayor, then the mayor would say, you will not coin it. The other guy still has the ability to undo the deal, let's say. Or you have the ability to undo the deal, whatever. Give it a mayor, Rebeliezer. Where does the Chachamim say that no, the Behemoth Doctor can be acquired with Meshicha? In addition to Hagbah, yeah. That's according to Rabbi Yehuda, according to the mayor and Rabbi Elazar. No, that wouldn't be enough. You actually have to pick it up. The Gemara tells, Dorash Rav b'Kimchunya. Rav one time gave it drasha in Kimchunya, the name of a city. Behema Gasa nichnas b'Meshicha. He once said that a Behema Gasa can be acquired with Meshicha. So Ashkechinu Shmuel the Talmid of Rav. So one time Shmuel met after that. Shmuel one time met the Talmid of Rav. Omalahu, and he asked them, Miyom Rab Behema Gasa Nichnas B'Meshicha. Did Rab really say that? Bahanan B'Mesira Tanan. We learned in our Mishnah Mesira. So according to Rashi, the point of the question is the Mishnah is saying Mesira only and not Meshicha. According to Tosfos, the point is that why is Rab saying only Meshicha if Mesira works as well? As a matter of fact, Rav used to always, Shmuel continues his question, Rav used to always say that Behema Gasa is Nichnas B'Mesira. Hodr Be Me'ahi, what he changed his mind from what he used to always say? The answer is, Huda Omer Ki Haitana. No, but Shmuel and Rav are colleagues. They didn't say that. But it's not a question of respect. He's asking. I mean, so what does Rav mean that he said this in his Drasha? Does that mean he changed his mind? So the answer is Huda Amaki Haitana. The answer is that yes, actually, Rav did change his mind because he went according to the following Tanya. The Tanya, because we learn in the Braise, that a Braise says that both a Behema Gasa and a Behema Daka can both be acquired with Meshicha. So therefore, Rav is holding according to that Braise. And the Braise continues, Rav Shimon, Rav Shimon says that no, both a Behema Gasa and a Behema Daka can only be acquired with Hagbah, which means that now you have four different opinions only. So now you have four different opinions, the two opinions in our Mishnah and two more in the Braise. Maskechot Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef says, if you're telling me, according to Rav Shimon, that you need Hagbah for any kind of animal, Elamat appeal to Rav Shimon, Mei Yikna. Then if you buy or acquire an elephant, how are you supposed to do Hagbah with it? No, it has to be lifting it. Definitely, it has to be lifting it up completely. There's no question about that. Well, you got enough people, maybe, but yeah. But no, if you just lift up one leg, that wouldn't be enough. Now, Mephoshim point out the question is maybe not so much necessarily if one person is selling it to the other, because you have other alternatives. If nothing else, you could always have the guy could go to Basin and be officially murdered. I've sold my elephant to Pliny, and I have no further claims on it. The question is really, let's say you find a hefker elephant and you want to be coined. How are you supposed to do it according to the shipment?
With a lion?
A lion doesn't weigh as much as an elephant. Conceivably, you sedate the lion, and then you can get a couple of people to lift it up, you know. I'm going to buy a chalifin. Okay, so Abai says you have ways. You can do kinyan a chalifin. And you coin it that way. As soon as you give the other guy the gaucho, then you coin it the elephant. Inami the circus of coin. Or you have another possibility. Rent the spot where the rent from the guy the spot where the elephant is standing. And then you coin it with kinyan chotzer or whatever it is. It's a bit of a machlokus whether this would be kinyan chotzer or kinyan agav. Is it that then, by having rented the spot, it would be considered your chaser, and therefore it's kinder for you? Or would it be what we're going to learn in the next mission, what we're going to talk about tomorrow, Kenyan Agab, that when you coin a character, you can automatically be coining the Taltalin along with it, even if the Taltalin aren't actually in that same location?
Can you say that Kenyan?
If we say that, then yeah. Rav Zera says, here's another possibility. Maybe Abba Kalim Manechem Tachas Raglav. Bring four Kalim and put him under his 4 feet. Meaning, so you pick up, you, no, you don't even have to pick the, you somehow convince the elephant to pick up 1 foot at a time, and each one, you take a big bucket over there and put the bucket down, and the elephant sticks its foot into the bucket, and soon it's standing. Well, no, with the circus, actually, you have it standing on platforms. That's going to be another thing. That's going to be another thing we're going to talk about in a minute. Here, we're not talking about Hagbah. Here, what we're talking about is that now you have the four legs of the elephant are standing inside four kalim of yours. Inside. You have four large buckets where each one is holding one leg of the so fine. You're kalim. Now you're cutting it with three of kalim.
That's pretty good. If he has four besides kalim, then... Mm-hmm.
The question is, the Gemara asks, Shamati not Caleb Shalakeh Beshus Merchakana?
That
have to be metal. No, that could be wooden, conceivable. I don't know, whatever. Yeah, that have to be strong Caleb, I guess, yeah. The question is, Shamati not Caleb Shalakeh Beshus Merchakana Lakeh? In that case, can you prove from this? Now, there's a machlokas. We have this back in Gittin, and the main place where the Gemara discusses is in Bava Basra. If you have, you're in the Moichur's Rishus, and Tosfos says we can assume that that's where this is taking place. And you, the Lekeach, bring your Kalim over there, and something is placed into those Kalim, will you be Kona? It's actually a machlokas over there. Based on what? Because the Kalim are not in your Rishus, they're in the Moichur's Rishus. Based on what Reb Zeira is saying, it sounds like you can answer that question. The answer is not necessarily because Chochav Ma'askin and Besimta. Because don't assume that we're talking over here in the Moichur's Rishus. Assume we're talking about over here in a Simta, a side area near Rishus Rabim, so it's not a full-fledged Rishus Rabim because your Kalim are definitely not going over there. It's not a Rishus Yachid because it doesn't belong to the Moichur. It's a side alleyway where business is commonly transacted, and that kind of place, everybody agrees that your Kalim can be kind of for you over there. Well, we don't know because it's a Macholikus over there in the Gemara. And the Gemara goes back and forth with proofs, and it didn't bring this as a proof. Inami b'chavila is modus. Or I can give you another answer: how going back to the original thing we were asking, how can you lift up an elephant and be koneh according to Reb Shimon? You use chavila is modus. You use bundles of branches. So Rashi says it's like this: you pile up branches on the ground until you have a height of at least 3 tefachim. You lead the animal onto this pile, and once you've gotten it 3 tefachim off the ground, yes, it's on the pile. but it's 3 tefachim off the surface of the ground. At that point, no, never mind Merkaz Rishus or not. At that point, once you've been magbia, in other words, we're saying, does not have to actually be you take the thing and pick it up like that. It can also be you cause it to be lifted up off the ground. How is that? Because you're making it stand on this pile of branches. Tosfos has a couple of problems with that. One of them is, why would we say you need 3 tefachim? L'chora, 1 tefach should be enough. And anyway, Tosfos says, if that's all it is, you're talking about lifting up the ground, why are we bothering mentioning this modus at all? Say, like you mentioned about the circus, you get a couple of platforms, each one or maybe 3 tefachim tall. You make the animal stand on those, and chasal. Why Dapka mentions specifically these modus? Wouldn't it be easier to do? No, okay, not maybe not surface platforms per se, but fine, whatever. Just build a wooden platform, a tefach or 3 tefachim tall. Anyway, Tosfos gives a different answer. Modus are the branches like that are something that elephants eat. Therefore, what you do is you hold the branches high up, and the elephant wants to eat them and it can't reach them, so it jumps to get them. According to Tosfos, 1 tefach is enough. I guess it would have to be that all 4 feet get off the ground at one time. Interesting. There is a discussion I saw a while ago on this from Nathan Slifkin. In reality, and biologically, can elephants jump like that? So he actually comes to the conclusion that not, and therefore he has a difficult time with the Tosfos. Yeah, they have them stand up on platforms. No, they don't have them. They don't have them jump. Yeah, but yeah.
I think it's possible the Chariot Shail.
What? He is, okay. Slifkin is a few years back. They made a big deal out of certain things that he wrote in some of his books, but whatever. That's, you know, no concern of ours, you know. But yeah, anyway. So either way, one way or the other, you have some way of doing hagbaha or some other form of kinyan, and therefore, yes, you can be koina an elephant just as much as you'd be koina any other animal. It definitely has to be all 4 legs, yeah.